Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, the perfect gift for the animal lover on your holiday gift list. Teresa Miller has a new book out. The former longtime director of the Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers has teamed up with the Kirkpatrick Foundation in creating an anthology devoted to the role animals play in our lives. 30 writers and poets, a mix of state and nationally known writers, have contributed work about their beloved pets, the animals that surround them in nature, and their work to preserve animals in their native habitats. It's titled Love Can Be, a literary collection about our animals, and it features writers like Scott Momaday, Joyce Carol Oates, Susan Orleans, Dean Koontz, and the late Ursula Le Guin, along with Oklahoma writers like P.C. Cast, Wayne Coyne, Clifton Talbot, Brandon Hobson, and Michael Wallace. That's just a few of the writers involved. And proceeds from the book benefit 6 animal rescue and humane organizations in the state. The book launch for Love Can Be takes place Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at Living Arts, sponsored by Magic City Books, and it will also feature a number of the contributors, S.E. Hinton, Michael Wallace, Clifton Talbot, Brandon Hobson, Kim Doner, Mary Logan Wolf, along with editors Louisa McCune, and my guest today, Teresa Miller. Teresa Miller, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rich. It's great to see you.
This is a very interesting collection. Tell us a little bit how this came about.
Wow, isn't it interesting? Love Can Be. And I was visiting with my good friend, Louisa McCune, who's executive director of the Kirkpatrick Foundation, and they are very committed to animal welfare in Oklahoma. And she was talking about doing some sort of an exhibit as a tribute to animals in conjunction with a conference she was having. And I said, how about a book? And she said, that's a great idea. And so we just decided that we put together this collection of well-known writers writing about their animals, and then use the proceeds of the book, and this is thanks to Louise and the Kirkpatrick Foundation, to benefit animal charities in Oklahoma. And so that was sort of the genesis of it, and it just grew as we became more involved and got so many great authors involved as well.
So how did you reach out to the authors that you have in the collection?
I call that the Tahlequah syndrome. I grew up in a little town, as you know, Rich, and we just assumed that we had access to everyone because in Tahlequah we did. So that's when, even when I was a kid, I was calling up actors like Marlo Thomas and Bill Cosby, I'm sorry to say, and Bob Denver from Gilligan's Island. And then I moved on to writers and I talked to Harper Lee on the phone. So I've never come to the realization that some people are off limits to me. And with writers, and of course through my career, I got to meet many of these people. And then writers are especially drawn to animals. And Louisa has a great introduction to the book when she points out how many writers have felt special bonds to their animals. John Steinbeck, notably.
Travels with Charlie.
Yeah.
Just a great
yeah.
book about traveling the country in
right.
a camper with his poodle.
Right. We even at one point reached out to Queen Elizabeth because of her corgis. Louisa wrote that official letter, and we actually got a letter back on Buckingham Palace stationery from one of her assistants saying that, you know, she just had too many requests and couldn't comply, but it was beautiful and so formal and everything. So somebody asked me once, did we have any rejections from the author? Well, only one, Queen Elizabeth.
And that was the best written and best looking rejection you ever got.
Oh, absolutely. Official with a seal and everything. So we should all be so lucky has been to be rejected by her.
Was it a matter of finding pieces that these authors had already written, or did many of them write things for the collection?
Many of them wrote things originally for the collection, and that was our hope, to get as many original pieces in the collection as reprints. Now, some of the we do have a few reprints that are classics that we wanted to include, but most of them actually are originals. And one classic example is Ursula K. Le Guin. I have a friend in common with Ursula, and my friend P.C. Cast, who's a well-known author, suggested that she could get in touch with Ursula, and Ursula's son became involved. And Ursula said she didn't have time to do an essay. Could she do a poem? And as it turned out, this was one of the last original poems that Ursula ever wrote. Actually, she died 2 weeks after we got the little poem from her called
wow.
The Cat.
Wow. Well, and you have it right here. Could you read it to us?
I absolutely do. I love this. It's very short. But do you have cats, Rich?
I don't. I used to have a cat, but we've moved to being dog people. We're sort of bilingual. We have cats for a while, then we have dogs.
But you know cats. You understand their temperament.
I do.
Well, here's what Ursula writes. The cat, he walks upon his paws to the places that he goes, followed by his tail and preceded by his nose. He knows what he is doing. He goes about his business. He need not explain it. He is being his isness. Isn't that delightful? It was funny. Joyce Carol Oates was involved with the anthology, and I mentioned to her that Ursula had done this piece, and she couldn't wait to read it. And Ursula had just died when I shared it with Joyce, and she said, this is really a treasure that we got this piece, and that Ursula cared so much about animals that she really wanted to do this. And we have a great photo of her and her cat, Pard. And in fact, one of the things I enjoy about the book is the great pictures of the authors with various animals, usually their own pets.
Now, when you were putting the collection together, you have a mix of Oklahoma authors as mm-hmm. well as people
yeah.
from around the country, national authors. Was that specific to this?
Yes, we wanted it to be bigger than Oklahoma. Not that Oklahoma isn't big in and of itself, but we thought it would be great for us to reach out to authors throughout the country, and we even have some outside the country, like Alexander McCall Smith, who lives in Scotland. And I've got to tell you, I just love McCall Smith. I sponsored two trips by him to Tulsa and love his piece on baboons and opera.
Yes, he was following research on baboons, right?
Right. Well, he's a scholar. I mean, yeah. His books are so readable and fun. I mean, I love the number one Ladies Detective Agency series. But he is a scholar. He's a medical ethicist. I mean, he has a rich and varied career. So he was on board immediately to help us and did this piece on the baboons and meeting some people who'd written this book about baboons who were thrilled to meet him because how many people had read their book? I mean, oh my gosh, he's read our book about baboons.
And so he ends up basically developing a libretto for an opera about baboons.
Baboons based on Macbeth.
Yes.
You know, that's an unusual idea.
Akavango Macbeth or something
right,
like that.
Right, that's exactly what it was. It opened in Botswana.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, who would have figured? And sometimes I worry in my life that I may be pushing the envelope too much with my own writing, but then I remember baboons and opera.
What surprised you most about the contributions you got? We'll talk about some of the themes that seemed to show up, but what most surprised you?
Well, I think the depth of affection and devotion these authors, no matter how famous they might be, felt for their animals. Joyce Carol Oates is a classic example. I mean, it's hard to think of a writer who has gotten more literary recognition and acclaim than Joyce Carol Oates. And yet, when I approached her about this project, I mean, she was on board immediately. She's a cat lover. And to show you what level we finally got to with the book, I one day, just on impulse, sent her a picture of my calico cat, Libby. And she wrote back and immediately emailed me back, and she said, what a gorgeous cat, like a Picasso painting, all the asymmetry. Well, I got teary-eyed, and I was calling people, and I said, oh, Joyce Carol Oates thinks Libby is gorgeous and all of this. And I thought, what's happened to me? I really thought this, Rich, because there was a time in my life that I would have gotten all emotional if Joyce Carol Oates had said something nice about my writing. Instead, I'm thrilled that she's praising my cat. And it was 2 weeks later, it was kind of late at night, my phone dinged, and I had a message, and it was from Joyce, and she had sent me a picture of her cat, Sheba. She just wanted me to see what Sheba looked like. And so I thought, you know, in spite of all of her notoriety and everything, she is interested and connected with her cats. And also, she does great work to foster cats.
Now, that was a poem as well, right?
Yes.
It was a lengthy poem.
Yes, Jubilate, a verse in catterel as opposed to doggerel. And she really considers catterel a very elevated form. And so that was fun. And, you know, it shows a little bit of her, even though she's a serious writer, her whimsy. And she writes children's books about her cat, Cherie. And she loves Cherie, so... Yeah.
Now, one of the common themes in this collection is the loss of a pet.
Yes.
And there's several very poignant essays on, I can't remember exactly which writer was writing it, but the absence of the clicking from the nails of,
yes.
of a dog on the
Susan
floor.
Susan Orlean.
Yes, right.
Dog memory.
Yeah.
You know, that is one of the hard parts of when you write about pets is that, you know, their lifespans are shorter. And so the loss is very much a part of the book. And I think that the way the authors dealt with it was really quite extraordinary and artful. And also, I think that all of them were very clear to point out that in spite of the loss and the hurt, they didn't regret their decision and their commitments to dogs. For example, Susan goes on in that essay to say that she knew she would have other dogs, that even with her grief, there was more in her relationship with that dog to encourage her to embrace other dogs as well.
My guest today is Teresa Miller, the Director Emerita of the Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers, accomplished writer herself, and co-editor along with Louisa McCune of Love Can Be, a literary collection about our animals. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press, and it would make a great gift for an animal lover this holiday season. And there'll be a number of signings in December, and all the proceeds from the book will benefit animal welfare organizations. I should mention, most of your authors donated their honoraria to a wide range of animal rescue and animal help organizations.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rich. First of all, I want to clarify that the book's actually published by the Kirkpatrick Foundation and distributed by the OU Press, and it's the net proceeds that go to six animal charities in Oklahoma. But what we did is we gave each author the opportunity to select an animal charity of their choice anywhere in the United States or even outside of the United States. And then we donated their honoraria to these various animal charities. And you're right, they're all over the country. We have a list of them in the back of the book. Elise Passion, for example, donated her honorarium to the Native American Humane Society. And people like Susan Orlean gave to a animal rescue fund for donkeys. Michael Wallace donated to an organization in Minnesota that is interested in monarch rescue. Adelia Efron was interested in animals that police dogs that are trained and helping them. And Dean Koontz, a very interesting man who's extremely committed to animal welfare and the animal-human connection, it had donated previously to an organization, and we donated again in his name, that uses animals, companion animals, to help people who are physically disabled. And that's been a great and successful project for him.
Several of the essays revolve around conservation. Julia Alvarez, for example, Juan Felipe Herrera, both poets, write about conservation. Rick Bass does a very interesting... It's also about how over eons we've naturalized and domesticated some animals, and yet there's not room for other animals in that domestication, and also sort of implying that because we can't domesticate them, there may not be room in the world for them. And it was a very, very poignant essay. So conservation is a big theme.
It is
in this
a very, very important point. And all the examples that you mentioned are terrific, but it reminds us that, you know, as animal lovers, we have even a larger responsibility in a way to the environment that surrounds our animals. And I think, like, Rick's essay is well taken. I mean, he's the first to admit that he has his dogs that, you know, are very domesticated, and he's a little bit embarrassed by how domesticated they are. And yet he's worried about these grizzlies and that we're down to 20 in his valley in Montana, and 20 aren't enough. I mean, we are actually seeing this whole species of animals eradicated.
Yeah.
And so he takes that approach. And you're right, the essays cover all kinds of different subject matter in addition to conservation. We talk about, you know, basic getting along with each other and how they can facilitate kinship and friendship. And it really is a very broad sweep of a book in that sense.
Juan Felipe Herrera wrote, he's a former poet laureate, and he wrote about a poem about the last white rhino.
Yeah, Sudan. That was a beautiful poem, and he was very touched and a very sweet guy. And I'll tell the story about Juan Felipe. He was, we gave his honorarium directly to him because he wanted to present it to the Fresno SPCA. So he went to the Fresno SPCA. And he read his poem to them and got his picture taken with all of them. And he saw two little mixed shepherd puppies there, and he was worried. They had been there a while, and he wanted to make sure they got a home. So he adopted those two puppies, and took them home to find them a forever home. And so he assumed that responsibility.
Julia Alvarez, you have another poem by her.
Yes.
And this is a really, getting back on that conservation theme, this is a, I thought this was one of the stronger poems in the collection.
Yeah, Julia Alvarez, amazing. And we have this picture. Of course, our audience can't see it, but she's feeding her chickens out on her farm that they had for a while. And it's in Vermont. But this is called Naming the Animals. And you and I talked ahead of time that I probably can't pronounce a lot of these names and that you said you probably couldn't either.
So just do the best you can.
I do. Okay. It's called Naming the Animals. And by the way, it goes along with another one called The Animals Review Pictures of a Vanished Race. I mean, that title is, and there's a humor in it too. And
no, it's animals looking at us as an anthropology project,
I know.
As we do old animals that are extinct.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Let's name the animals no longer with us, except in language. Start with the dodo, the Haitian long-tongued bat, the dwarf emu, the laughing owl, the eastern buffalo, and then animals like the nukapu, the lorikeet, the broad-faced potoroo, whose absences don't sadden me as much as I can't put a picture to their names. Two potoroos, say, lounging in their den with baby potoroos clamoring over them. I think of Adam watching the parade of just created animals, their forms still taking shape. So had he touched too hard, the camel might have had some extra humps. The colors might have smudged on the peacock, which wasn't yet a peacock, but a thing. A brightly colored, gorgeous, feathered thing in need of a name, as was the camel, the marmoset, the deer, the parakeet, waiting to enter language and be claimed. But now we, Adam's babies, find ourselves uttering names no one comes up to claim. No iridescent, billed, web-footed thing quacks back when we say, Laguat Gelinote. In fact, unless we say the name out loud or write it down, the Gelinote is gone. And so our language, which singles us out from dwarf emus, nukapus, potoroos, becomes an elegy, as with each loss, our humaneness begins to vanish, too.
Yeah, very
that
nice.
That last line, I mean, beautiful, beautiful poem.
Yeah. My guest today is Teresa Miller, co-editor, along with Louisa McCune, of Love Can Be, a literary collection about our animals. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I have to ask about your own story that you have, the one-eyed dog named Tuffy.
Yes, Tuffy.
Tell us all about this story. Was this something you wrote for the collection or had,
yes,
something you wrote before?
No, I wrote it for the collection, and my reason for doing it was I thought I'm asking all of these people to write essays and I should not ask them to agree to anything I won't do myself. And I would never have thought of writing about Tuffy, but Tuffy was my mother's dog. And I grew up with Tuffy. He was a one-eyed dog. Shortly after my mother's death, she had rescued him. He was hit by a car, and the vet was really encouraging my father to put him down. And my dad said, we can't, you know, not after we've lost everything. My mother died with my brother's birth. And so Tuffy became the one-eyed dog in Tahlequah. That was his pedigree because we didn't have any other one-eyed dogs in town. And so everybody talked about the one-eyed dog. And those were the days, Rich, when dogs in small towns were usually free range. But Tuffy stuck closely with us, and he really led me through my childhood. So it was a great pleasure for me and very emotional to reach back and write about him. And I found what triggered this, I was going through some things my grandmother had saved for me that had belonged to my mother. And one was my baby book, and she had written down my first words. And my first words were Moon, Splash, and Tuffy. really, it was sort of a mantra for going on without her. And Tuffy figured very prominently in that.
Yeah. And there's also the poignant element of as you, and you write about this, this is, you know, as you grew older into teenage years, your pet, so important to you at one age, but sort of takes a back seat to other things as you move out into the world.
Yes, it's part of the transitional process that we all go through in growing up, and then dealing with loss as well, because when it started out, you know, Tuffy to us was, you know, my grandmother would always gather me, pull me in with her in front of the cedar chest where she had my mother's memorabilia. And I associated that with such sadness and grief. And then I would think of Tuffy, and that was, I could be close to my mother through Tuffy, but he was, you know, smelled of sunshine and fresh air and children. And initially, my brother and I, we followed Tuffy everywhere. But as we got older, it switched and he started following us. And he would come to school and, you know, we were kind of, because of our family situation and because I didn't have a mother, kids always kind of wondered about what it was like for us at home. And not that it was anything weird, but it was just different from what most children expected. Like we'd make Mother's Day cards and kids would want to know who got them. And one day I was feeling very self-conscious and there was Tuffy. He'd come to school and he was looking in the window and everybody said, "Oh, look, there's the one-eyed dog." And I had never felt so proud and so validated. I mean, it was better than having a parent come to school at that point in my life. Because,
that's funny.
Yeah. And so it was Tuffy. And he even started coming into the school, but they put a stop to that.
Well, another theme in some of the essays is about animal rescue.
Blake, right.
Blake Bagley, wonderful writer.
Oh, isn't he?
Writes a really wonderful essay about his own animal rescue of a neighbor's dog that wasn't being taken care of. And what I loved about it was even though, he comes in and performs his own animal rescue, he's not judgmental of the family next door.
No.
They were having their own issues and own problems. And it was a very humane essay, I thought.
It was very humane, and Pupasaurus was what he named the dog. He told me later that his mother made them change the name to Gracie. She refused to call the dog Pupasaurus. But Blake was one of the, you know, when I reached out to him, he immediately came on board because he loves animals. And it is a very great story about not only how he rescued this animal, but Pupasaurus, but how Pupasaurus actually brought great joy to him and his wife and later his little girl. So, you know, he enriched their lives as well.
Yeah. Other stories of rescue in the book.
Well, one of the most prominent that comes to my mind is Kim Doner's essay about rescuing a raccoon. And for those people who've ever wondered what you do if a wild raccoon got lost in your car, I mean, I've wondered about that, haven't you, Rich? Anyway, Kim gives us the background for that and what you do in a case like that. But Kim's very involved with Wing It, and Wing It is one of the groups that will be receiving some of the proceeds for the book. And so she rescues raccoons with the idea, and all kinds of wildlife, she and the Wing It group, with the idea of releasing them back to nature and getting them back into the wild, which is kind of what Rick Bass was getting at, too. We don't want to take the wild out of wildlife. She doesn't try to make pets of them, but she tries to get them back into their natural environment.
Yeah. I have to mention, it's not just pets, too, because just as the wild animal rescue and the raccoons, Raina Grande and Michael Wallace also both tell stories that have to do with monarch butterflies.
Isn't that interesting that they both chose monarchs and from very different, you know, and Raina's relates very closely to migration and her role. She was undocumented and for a while, and she uses the butterfly, the monarch, to explain migration to her daughter, and it's a beautiful essay and very timely. I mean, couldn't be more timely. And then Michael's butterfly, his monarch, relates to everything from Pretty Boy Floyd to really the resurrection of life and, you know, the new chances and resilience. And it's a lovely, lovely essay and very different from a lot of the things Michael had written. It's almost poetic.
It really is very different from what Michael writes. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this collection is you see writers who you are used to seeing in a certain way. Blake Bailey is another way because he's writing about famous writers for the
Philip
most part.
Roth right now.
Right.
And then here he is, and you see that not only is he interested in Philip Roth, he's also very interested in this pit bull that he rescued.
Well, I have to mention one other essay that's in there because for public radio listeners, they'll recognize the name immediately, and that's Diane Rehm.
Right.
And in fact, I was just opening the mail today and got a nice little card from a listener who said, at the very end, says, "I still miss Diane Rehm."
Of course. Isn't she a wonderful person?
Yeah.
And I've known her indirectly through the years and was on her show once she wasn't there. But we have mutual friends, and I knew she had a little chihuahua named Maxie. And Maxie was a contentious little dog. She claims it's because some neighbor kids dropped him on his head. But he bit a lot of famous people in Washington. But she loved Maxie. Maxie went to work with her on a regular basis, and it was a great companion to her. So this is a cause that is close to her heart as well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a wonderful collection. What was the process of winnowing it down? Did you get more than you could use at this point, or just you put everything in that you received?
We put everything in, because when you're dealing with writers of this caliber and asking for a favor, it's not like we are putting out any kind of special dictates as to what they need to do. And that's the great blessing of the Kirkpatrick Foundation. They were so open. Louisa, who's executive director and, as you mentioned earlier, co-editor, they were all so open to making the book whatever we needed it to be. So there was never any kind of restriction on the content or the amount of it. It just worked out that we got 30 authors to contribute, and it turned out to be a good number and just about the right size.
As far as editing, it was very interesting, because you, other than Ursula Le Guin going at the beginning, you put everything in alphabetical order.
That is a funny story. Louisa and I, you know, we had several different scenarios that we would come up with for how we would organize it according to theme, like the themes that we've been talking about, environmental themes and rescue themes and loss and grief themes. And then we finally decided one day, Louisa said, well, I wonder what would happen if we just did this alphabetically. And we put it together alphabetically, and we thought, you know, this fits together really well. And when you have writers that are all of such great stature, who are you going to put last? Does it signify anything? The one exception, and you noted that, was Ursula K. Le Guin. She had passed away. You know, the very day, actually, that we sent her contract to the agent was the day she died. And so we just felt that that was an important tribute to her, to include her first. But every other author's in alphabetical order, and I think it flows pretty well. I think it flows as well as any way we could have arranged it.
Yeah. Well, I do want to mention your first signing, which is coming up this Sunday. And because this will not only be a chance for people to pick up the collection and talk to you and Louisa, but also a number of the contributors.
Isn't that fun? Yeah.
I mean, you have S.E. Hinton, Michael Wallace, Clifton Talbert, Brandon Hobson, Kim Doner, Mary Logan Wolf, and the two editors, all together for one signing.
We're looking forward to it, and we're lucky to have everybody on board. Susie, by the way, writes about her horse, Toyota, which is great fun.
Yeah.
The star of Tex.
Yeah. So that takes place this Sunday from 3 to 5 at Living Arts, Magic City Book Launch. So it'll be great. And again, tell us the organizations that will be benefiting from this book.
Okay, there's six in Oklahoma, and we have, and it was really fun to be able to include all of their bios in the back of the book. But we have the Tulsa SPCA, the Wild Care Foundation, we have the Joan Kirkpatrick Animal Hospital, Wildlife in Need Group, that's Winget, I had mentioned them earlier, the Bella Foundation, and the Enid Society for the Prevention of Cruelty for Animals. And so all good groups. And, you know, even as we say that, there's greater need than that. And that's why we had the authors donate their honoraria. And in Tulsa, for example, we had authors donate to things like the Humane Society, to Street Cats, and several other organizations throughout Oklahoma have benefited.
All right. Well, Teresa, wish you great success with Love Can Be.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Writer Teresa Miller is the co-editor of the new collection Love Can Be, a literary collection about our animals. Proceeds benefit several animal welfare agencies within the state. It's published by the Kirkpatrick Foundation with the University of Oklahoma Press. The book launch for Love Can Be will take place this Sunday at 3 o'clock at Living Arts, and will feature the two editors along with S.E. Hinton, Michael Wallace, Clifton Talbert, Brandon Hobson, Kim Doner, and Mary Logan Wolf, all contributors to the collection. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.